This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Thank you. I always enjoy coming to Santa Barbara. The applause is nice. I'm Wade Clark Roof, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this particular lecture of the Walter H. Capps Center for the Study of Ethics, Religion, and Public Life. This is a very special event, the inaugural lecture in a year-long series of special events commemorating the life and legacy of Walter Capps. 10 years have passed since Walter died, and we all remember his many and important contributions to the community, to the nation, and to UCSB. Today's event is co-sponsored by the UCSB affiliates, the Department of Political Science, the Office of the Chancellor, the Office of Public Relations, the Orfila Center for Global and International Studies, the UC Institute for Global Conflict and Cooperation, Santa Barbara City College, and the Continuing Education Division. This event has also been made possible through the generous support by Gary and Mary Becker. To all of these units and people, I extend my appreciation. Before we have the lecture, I would like to recognize the presence of several distinguished guests. Congresswoman Capps. Daughter Laura Capps. UC Regent Judith Hopkinson. Chancellor and Mrs. Young. We're so pleased that all of you are here, and indeed all of you, for this special event. If any of you are new to the Capps Center and its programs and activities and would like to know more about what we do, we have a sign-up list sheet out front where you can put down either your email address or your regular mail address, and we'll be happy to send you notices about our events. At the close of today's lecture, our speakers agreed to take questions from the floor. If you have a question, please approach one of the microphones, and I will recognize you. Courtesy of Borders, we have copies of Lee Hamilton's books for purchase and signing. The two books are Thomas H. Keene and Lee H. Hamilton, Without Precedent, The Inside Story of the 9/11 Commission, and James A. Baker III and Lee H. Hamilton, The Iraq Study Group Report, The Way Forward, A New Approach. Book signing will take place here on the stage. The Capps Center is nonpartisan and nonsectarian. It exists to address major social and ethical issues and seeks to bring into our highly charged public arena a rational, considerate voice. The values we promote are those of dialogue, civility, ethical sensitivity, honesty and truthfulness in the public arena, democracy, the quest for common ground, and responsible citizenship. All values shared by Walter Capps. These are also values important to today's speaker. Lee Hamilton is president and director of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and director of the Center on Congress at Indiana University. Prior to those positions, he represented Indiana's 9th Congressional District for 34 years, beginning in January 1965. Most recently, he served as co-chair of the Iraq Study Group, a forward-looking, bipartisan assessment of the situation in Iraq. created at the urging of Congress. He served as vice chair of the 9/11 Commission and co-chair of the 9/11 Public Discourse Project, established to monitor implementation of the Commission's recommendations. He serves on numerous committees in Washington addressing issues of war, nuclear weaponry, and national security. This afternoon, his lecture topic is Time for a Course Correction, American Foreign Policy After Iraq. Please join me in welcoming Lee Hamilton.
Thank you, sir. You did your homework.
Good afternoon to all of you, and thank you very much for coming. I want to begin with a few words about Walter Capps. I remember to this day when I first met him. I was the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee in the House. I was seated at the rostrum, and Walter came up to the rostrum and with that long reach of his, reached over the rostrum and said, "Mr. Chairman, I'm Walter Capps. I'm from Santa Barbara." And I said to myself immediately, I knew a lot about him because that's the job of a chairman of a committee, to know a lot about their members. And I immediately liked the easy manner, the lack of pretense, the down-to-earthness of this man. There's a very popular word in politics today, and the word is authentic. Everybody's looking for the authentic candidate for president. Walter Capps was authentic. He gained influence in the House by sense, not by noise, by generosity of spirit, not meanness, by learning, not ignorance, by being a person comfortable with all of his diverse colleagues, and maybe most importantly, comfortable with himself. And by applying his high ethics and religious teachings to the complex problems of civic life and political life. So I'm very grateful for the life of Walter Capps. I am very grateful that you extend that memory and that influence. And of course, I'm enormously pleased that Lois Capps is here today. What a thrill it is to see her take over from Walter's position, firmly, steadily, growing each day in stature and effectiveness. And Lois, it is a great, great pleasure for Nancy and me to be with you today. Now, Dr. Roof did his homework. He said, "I'd been in the Congress for 34 years. I'll tell you a little story about that. The day I announced my retirement, I said, I made a very bad mistake. I did a little bragging. I guess that's always a mistake. I said I'd been in the Congress for 34 years and I had cast over 16,000 votes. I went back to my office, had a call from a constituent. "Lee, I understand you were in the Congress 34 years. I said, "Yes." He said, "I understand you cast 16,000 votes. I said, "Yes." He said, "I want you to know you finally made a decision I agree with." Dr. Roof, that's why I like these nice introductions. I had a lot of fun in the Congress. I hope Lois is now. It's a lot of hard work, but it's also a lot of fun. I I remember to this day the all-time best bumper sticker. Nothing approaches it. We had a Catholic priest who was a member of Congress. His name was Father Drinan. I think it's the case that a Catholic priest cannot be a member of Congress today, but back then he could. He had a bumper sticker that said, "Vote for Father Drinan or go to hell." I never had that kind of courage myself in Indiana. I used to keep track, Lois, I don't know if you've ever done this, I used to keep track of things that people say on the floor of the House, and one day we were debating the Middle East. Seems to me we were debating the Middle East all the time, but one fellow got up in the middle of the debate and said, "I don't see why the Arabs and the Israelis can't settle this thing, just like good Christians ought to." And I picked up the other day a biography of Alice Roosevelt Longworth, America's most famous first daughter, the daughter of Teddy Roosevelt. She had a world-famous needlepoint pillow in her house. It said this, kind of reflects the mores of Washington: "If you can't say something good about someone, sit right here next to me." And another fellow in the debate said, "If Lincoln were alive today, he'd be turning over in his grave." And in Indiana, they'd have caught that a lot quicker than you folks did. During a trade debate, one member got his metaphors mixed up, and he said, "If you don't stop shearing the sheep that lays the golden egg, we'll pump it dry." I'll get to the lecture here in a moment, Dr. Roof. I want to tell you this story, though. I'm not sure it's true, but it's a good story. One congressman bet another one $5 he could not repeat the Lord's Prayer. The other congressman said he could, and he began to recite it. "Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep." And the other congressman handed him $5 and said, "I just didn't think you could do it." Well, I guess it's time to get to work. I want to talk a little bit about American foreign policy in the days ahead. I think American foreign policy today confronts a basic paradox, really. We are, all of us would agree, I believe we would, the world's most powerful nation, certainly the strongest military, the largest economy, the most extensive cultural influence around the world, the highest level of technology. And yet, America's ability to accomplish things abroad, at least in my memory, has rarely been so limited as it is today. How do we explain it? How do we explain this paradox, if you would, of seemingly unlimited power, but very limited influence? After the attacks of September 11, 2001, President Bush set some astonishing goals for United States foreign policy. We would defeat terrorism, I'm paraphrasing him now, and states that sponsor terrorism, and we would not hesitate to take preemptive action to do so. We would defer and deter hostile regimes that sought weapons of mass destruction, specifically, of course, the so-called Axis of Evil. We would abandon support for stability in the Middle East, which, of course, had been our policy. And we would bring about a democratic transformation throughout the region. We would ensure that no nation in the world arose to be a competitor to U.S. hegemony. And to implement those actions or those goals, we began some very robust actions. We launched a global war against terrorism. We repeatedly spurned the international system that was largely of our own creation, rejecting a number of international norms and treaties. We invaded Afghanistan. We refused to engage with adversaries. We did not talk to them. We invaded, of course, and occupied Iraq. It's very hard now to look back to the year 2003 when we toppled Saddam Hussein and to remember the sense of victory and triumph that we had at that moment. And I remember several people speaking about, openly and favorably, speaking about an American empire around the world. Today, to fast forward, we confront a very different international landscape. And everywhere we turn, we see the limitations of American power. In Iraq, the definition of success has been lowered almost with each passing month. In Afghanistan, we struggle against a resurgent Taliban. American casualties are rising. The opium trade is rampant. In Pakistan, Al-Qaeda has reconstituted a sanctuary in that country. And of course, its leaders in recent days have just flatly ignored us. In Iran, a defiant president chastises us, foments instability in Iraq, and continues to pursue a nuclear program. Russian President Putin compares the United States to the Third Reich, openly defies us. And across the Islamic world, extremism only seems to be growing and increasing, and the cause of democracy seems to be stalled. Now, the truth is, at least from my perspective, that we are not the omnipotent power that we thought we were in 2003, nor are we the impotent power that we sometimes appear to be today. I do not accept or agree with the view that America has somehow gone into a state of permanent decline. Far from it. But I do believe America's power is diminished. Others may see us as a great nation, but one whose military limitations have been exposed in Iraq, whose economic strength has been challenged by the rise of China. If you sit down in almost any meeting in Washington today, everybody's talking about China and China and China and its emerging strength. And our exemplary model has certainly been tarnished by some of our responses to 9/11. And our ability to mobilize the world into cooperative action has suffered a blow. Not, of course, a fatal blow. But we are not merely a prisoner of world events. It is my view that, and many others, of course, that if we do not lead, more often than not, progress is not made. And where Lois works and where I used to work in the Capitol every day, you're impressed with leaders coming into Washington, sometimes kings, sometimes foreign ministers, sometimes finance ministers, day after day. I don't think there's a day go by that one of these distinguished visitors is not in Washington. Why do they come there? They come for one simple reason. They want help. Sometimes they want military help. Sometimes they want economic help, trade. Sometimes they want aid. Sometimes they want a photo op with the president. But they come, looking to us for leadership on practically everything, but especially for peace and for prosperity. I went in to see the National Security Advisor some months ago now, and on his desk there were a stack of files about this high, and must have been 25, 30 of them. I said, "What are those?" And he said to me, "Those are all extremely important matters that must be dealt with today." There was another stack of files on the other side of his desk, about the same size. I said, "What are those?" He said, "Those are all urgent matters." And it's true, isn't it? I mean, every problem, many of which you and I know about, many we don't know about, comes to the White House. And they want some help. And the challenge, of course, is to sustain effective American leadership over the long term. And to do that, we're going to have to move aggressively to restore our place in the world. We're going to have to be confident and open and tolerant and compassionate as a society. We're going to have to deal with the world as it is, not as we'd like it to be. And we're going to have to try very hard to make it a better place. And the challenge, of course, is to unite our power and our principles. I think what Americans want is American leadership on behalf of the world, where our interests, and there are many of them, are protected, where we work with like-minded nations, where the values of liberty and justice and freedom and opportunity are the norm, not the exception, and where, to quote that marvelous phrase of Martin Luther King, the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice. So to achieve that, we have to have a foreign policy that is visionary and pragmatic. We've got to recognize a lot of dangers and establish a lot of priorities and seize a lot of opportunities. I don't think the United States has been the most powerful nation in the world because of the strength of our arms or because of the amount of money we've got in the bank. It's because we've served as a beacon of hope and opportunity to the world. I do not subscribe to the view that America is fundamentally flawed or even diseased, and I don't agree with the people who think our best days are behind us. I don't subscribe either to the view that we never make mistakes or that we are somehow superior to others. I think our challenges are formidable. I don't think it's written in the stars anywhere that the United States is always going to be number one. But I do believe that our system is resilient, that we are capable of solving our problems, and that we are capable of making an ever more perfect union, and that we will, and that we can, and we must develop a country that is fairer and healthier and better educated and, of course, more secure. I understand we stray from our ideals. I understand we can sometimes be arrogant with others. But we are blessed with a durable constitution, enormous resources in this country, an energetic and talented, capable people in a free and open society. And I think we really do believe in our hearts that democracy is the best form of government, and it's worth all of our efforts to try to extend it. It does reflect our interests and our ideals. Now let me tell you what some changes I'd like to see in American foreign policy. I'll go so far as to predict that many of these will become true no matter who you elect President of the United States next year. I hope we'll be less likely to divide up the world between evil and good. What about King Abdullah in Saudi Arabia? Anybody think he's a Democrat? You and I are pretty dependent on him, aren't we? We can't get along without him, can we? If he shuts that valve off, we're not in trouble 6 months from now. We're in trouble this afternoon. You got to deal with that. We give a lot of speeches around the world on promoting democracy. I've given a few myself. We don't give them in Riyadh. We got to have that oil. Every president I know has talked about the Persian Gulf being vital to America. Presidents don't use the word vital casually. Vital means vital. It means we got to have it. Good, evil. The world's a lot more complicated than that. I hope we'll have a better sense of what we can achieve and what we cannot achieve by acting alone in the world. I hope we'll have a better sense of our goals and to match our goals with available resources. We have never put into Iraq the resources necessary to achieve our very grandiose goals there, either in terms of number of troops on the ground or even in terms of money being spent. We've not come close to providing the resources to meet the goals that we have set. 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, today. I hope we'll reject these grandiose calls of ending tyranny in the world. Does anybody believe we can do that?
No.
Look, when I was a young man, I was young at one point, I listened to John F. Kennedy give that speech. We'll pay any price, we'll bear any burden in defense of freedom. And I said, right on. We don't do that. I was talking to one of my scholar friends at the Woodrow Wilson Center the other day. I'll mention the Woodrow Wilson Center several times because in my contract I get a bonus every time I mention it. You'll just have to put up with that for a while. I was talking to one of them the other day, and he said, I asked him, I said, look, I've been reading about these troubles in the Great Lakes region of Africa. Tell me a little about them. He said, over the last few years, 4 million people have died. I can't even remember reading about it. I follow the news pretty carefully. I read the daily newspapers. 4 million people died. One area of the world. Bear any burden, pay any price? Of course not. Now, I understand presidents have to set visions. But I think some of them are overstated. I hope we'll make a greater effort to build consensus on the use of force, both domestically and internationally. The toughest decision you make, and as a member of Congress, is do you send young men and women into war? I know the votes. They're pretty overwhelming usually. But I'll tell you this, I never voted once without worrying about that. Here I was, a policymaker, supposedly, going home to a nice dinner every night, sitting around a big fancy table, sending young men and women to die. I hope we'll think about that a little harder. Look, don't misunderstand me. I understand we have to use force. I appreciate deeply the power of the American military. I admire them. But I know how easy it is for somebody to sit in Washington, D.C. and make that judgment, and how hard it is for the young people of this country to bear the burden. I hope we'll have a greater appreciation for our allies and international institutions. Look, I know working with the United Nations is tough. It's frustrating. It's disappointing that not a person in this room that hadn't been disappointed with the United Nations from time to time. But the United Nations has the power worldwide to bestow legitimacy. Now, that's a fancy word. I'm not sure I could define it for you. Take it up with the political scientists in the audience. We don't agree with that as Americans. But the world does. And we can't ignore that, as we found to our displeasure in Iraq. We're carrying all the burden in Iraq. I know they talk about coalition forces all the time. I was in Baghdad for a long time, never saw anybody other than American forces. Where are the coalition forces? I couldn't find them. We're doing it all. I hope we'll appreciate allies, work with the United Nations. I hope we'll be more pragmatic and not so ideological in our decisions in foreign policy. The American people are supposed to be pragmatic above everything else. It's a basis of so much of our success. And I think you have to be pragmatic when you talk about American foreign policy. And you can't say you're going to have Jeffersonian democracy in Saudi Arabia. I'm not sure we've got it in Indiana. I know you have it in Santa Barbara. We've got to be pragmatic about these matters and less ideological in our policies and ask ourselves what's going to work in this situation. What's a reasonable goal? I've been looking at Iraq for a long time now. I can't tell you precisely what the president's goal is in Iraq. I cannot tell you. I hope we'll be less willing to try to make other nations fit our mold. We talk a lot about democracy promotion, and I guess we should, but it's a very tough thing to do to bring democracy to the world. You've got to have a lot of skills. Secretary Gates gave a marvelous speech the other day. Talked about soft power, and he said, I, as Defense Secretary, I'm going to support a larger increase for the State Department and for AID and other agencies. Of course, he's also going to support a larger increase for the military, but that's understandable too. He pointed out that we spend, can't remember the figure, almost half a trillion, isn't it, Lois, on the Defense Department, and that doesn't include the wars. That doesn't include the wars. I understand why the American people want to have the finest military in the world. I do too. What I've never understood is why they are not willing to have the finest diplomacy in the world. I hope we're going to see a better balance of power between the President and the Congress. Lois, I'm going to say some things here that are going to make you uneasy. Congress is too timid. Lois is not too timid. The Congress is too timid. The Congress shall have the power to declare war. Anybody believe that? I asked a group of historians the other day, when's the last time we declared war? They couldn't remember. Finally, one of them put up his hand and said, I think it was against Bulgaria in 1943. I don't know whether he was right or wrong. What difference does it make? We've gone to war again and again. We've intervened again and again. If you look at the history of our country since the end of the war, it's been about once every 2 years that we intervene militarily somewhere, sometimes very quickly, in Grenada, out of Grenada, sometimes very long, in Iraq, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and maybe a lot more. the Congress shall have the power to declare war. I know that 2007 isn't 1789. I understand that. I appreciate it. But I've come to this view, my friends, and that is the president makes the decision as to whether or not you intervene. The Congress does not make that decision. The president makes it. And you got to make sure that the president of the United States looks for advice and counsel beyond his circle of immediate appointees. My hope is that in the future we will not hype threats, that we will not underestimate costs, that we will not paint unrealistic futures, and that we will not savage those who disagree with us. America's power has to rest, of course, upon a strong domestic foundation. And what happens in the United States will be as important to the success of our foreign policy as what happens abroad. If our economic growth is robust, it will encourage other nations to follow the free market system. If our democracy is strong and vibrant and fair, our example will attract other countries to follow our political system. If we're less dependent upon foreign oil and gas, we're not going to be so tied to events in the Middle East. If we did not have such a substantial trade deficit with countries like China, and we're not so dependent upon them to finance our debt, we'd have a lot more freedom of action in economic affairs. I was reading a big article about that this morning. I had to walk around half of Santa Barbara to get a copy of the New York Times this morning. I don't know what you folks read here. I know this, there are about 10 stores downtown that don't carry the New York Times, especially at 7 o'clock in the morning. And if we're united and a little less polarized in this country, we would be more able to tackle the tough challenges that we have and support and sustain our important foreign policy. One of the recommendations of the Iraq Study Group was that we needed a unity of effort in this country. I don't know where you come from on the war, but I think all of us would have to agree that we simply haven't been able to get a unity of effort in this country on the war. Now, that's not easy. No, not easy. But I know that American foreign policy is stronger worldwide when the world perceives America as being unified in its foreign policy. And what does that mean? Well, it means that both sides got to give a little in order to get unity of effort. Now, I'm going to move now to my final point here. I was looking down at Dr. Roof. He's getting mighty nervous here. I'm going too long. My final point is the top policymakers in the United States must not be dismissive of the views of the American people. There's a powerful strain of elitism in American foreign policy, a feeling by policymakers that the American people are not well informed enough about these complex matters, that they're not able to master... That's all right, hold the applause, I've had enough. I appreciate it very much. I've had a lot worse, I can tell you that. They say that they're not able to master the subject, that they're guided the American people by passion and not by intellect. And the country would be better off if we left these serious matters to the elites. If I've heard it once, I've heard it 1,000 times. Trust me, I know Or, Hamilton, if you'd only seen the intelligence I've seen. You know what I think? I think we would be better advised to read the Psalms carefully. Trust, put not your faith in princes. Take a look at the polls today. One, the people want us to disengage from Iraq responsibly. Two, the people want us to take out Osama bin Laden and known terrorists. Three, the people want us to engage in diplomacy with our adversaries, not just our friends. Four, the people want us to reduce our dependence on oil. Five, the people want us to maintain strong alliances. All of those from a poll I read just a couple of weeks ago. And you know what I thought about it? I looked at it and I said, well, that makes pretty good sense to me. In Indiana, we'd call it a down-home judgment. I can't think of what you'd call it in a town like Santa Barbara. You folks are a lot more sophisticated than I am. It's a down-home judgment. I don't romanticize that the people are always right. I do suggest that the policymaker sometimes needs a harness and that we should not invariably put our trust in princes. And to succeed, U.S. foreign policy must have a sensitive ear, always respectfully tuned to the voice of the people. I think a voice of pragmatism as we shape our policies. And so, my friends, America cannot shrink from global leadership. We have to protect our people and our interests across the world. We must lead on behalf of global progress. We have to retreat. We cannot retreat from the world. I hear that every now and then. I don't know if you have it out here. I get it more in the Midwest, I guess. And that's not an option. Incidentally, I spoke at Earlham College not long ago. Earlham College is a little Quaker school in Indiana. Just before I went out on the stage, the president of the college said, Lee, now you got to be careful here. All of these students are Quakers. They're very liberal. And they're all pacifists. I said, okay, Mr. President. I went out and gave the speech. First hand went up. Young man, I bowed to him. I was getting ready for one of these left-wing questions. He said, Congressman, when are we going to bomb Iran? I turned to that president and said, Mr. President, you really misled me here. Look, we can't dictate our terms to the world, and we have to be aware of our power and its limitations. We've got to avoid the temptation of being infatuated with foreign adventures. I'm reading now one of the biographies of John Adams and John Quincy Adams, his son, father, son, president, and that's one of the things they talked a lot about. Avoiding the temptation of infatuation with foreign adventures. You probably thought that was my language. I took it from John Quincy Adams. We have to stand up for our interests. We have to seek consensual solutions. We have to be sensitive to the human condition around the world. Many of you in this room have traveled extensively. You know how fortunate and lucky you are to be a resident of this community. You know the burden that so many people have, worrying about food and shelter. They can't really think about education or health care. They just got to try to figure out how to survive the day. We've got to be sensitive to that human condition around the world, and we have to be sensitive to the universal quest for dignity. Let me tell you, my friends, I reject an American foreign policy that argues for either realism or idealism, either freedom or security, either values or interests. The fact of the matter, American foreign policy has to incorporate all of them. And I hope instead of that we will recognize the limits of our power. That doesn't mean we compromise our ideals. I think we have to be idealists without illusions and pragmatists with a vision. Instead of merely seeking confrontation with those who oppose us, we should push relentlessly for opportunities for people all around the world. Instead of thinking that peace and security can come alone through military strength or come alone through diplomatic activity, we must know that peace and security come through an integrated and skillful and prudent use of all of the tools of American power, not just the military, not just the diplomatic or political, but an integration of all the tools. And our government isn't set up very well to do that. We've got a Department of Defense over here, a Department of State over here, and a Department of Justice here, and a Department of Agriculture there. And they're very good. We've got a lot of very good people in each of these departments. But what we fail to do is integrate effectively all of these tools of power. And instead of trying to tackle the problems of the world by ourselves, I hope we'll share the burden with others and to seek a world order that is, of course, peaceful and just and prosperous. And instead of pushing for an international system built on our image, let's follow the flowering of American diplomacy right after World War II, when we certainly acted in our interests. It was Truman and Acheson and Paul Nitze and all of these, George Kennan, all of these giants of American diplomacy. What did they do? They acted for the American national interest, for sure. But they identified the American national interest with the broader interest of other countries around the globe. And so we fashioned a world in that great period of American diplomacy that has served us well, I would argue, over a period of decades. And so we have to have a realistic and balanced view of American power. And that's what I've tried to say to you this afternoon. And Dr. Roof, if you want to come up, we'll take a few questions. Okay?
Thank you very much. You probably know Congress and how it works better than anybody. And I have a third rail kind of question, especially in this environment. If the draft had been in place when Congress was considering the entry into the most recent Iraq incursion, do you think that the draft, which would have spread the sacrifice more evenly within our society, would have helped Congress put on the brakes and think more cautiously about entry? And if it does have that kind of impact, since the draft is so politically unpalatable, is there some substitute for that that would help Congress do a better job next time?
It's, of course, a highly speculative question. My own judgment would be that even with the draft, this president would have gone into Iraq. I never had any question in my mind. And you shouldn't have either if you'd just read what he said in the lead-up to the war, that he was going to go to war against Saddam Hussein. And he could not go to the next election without removing Saddam Hussein. He made that very, very clear. So we would have gone to war with or without a draft, I think. I do think, however, that if you had a draft, our exit from Iraq would be quicker than it is today. I can't prove either one of those, but that would be my judgment about it. Now, what do we do about it in the future? That's the tough part.
Any substitute for that?
Ma'am?
Any substitute for the draft that would have that kind of push?
Well, the difficulty with the draft is not just politically, as I'm sure Lois could say better than I, that there just aren't the votes for it there.
Yeah.
If you have a draft, you have to figure out some way of dealing with the millions of people that are eligible for the draft that you don't need. Right. And so you have to go to a lottery or something or other, and there's a kind of a fundamental unfairness about all of that. But it's so academic at this point that I just don't think it's all worthy of discussion. We do have a serious problem in the military, and that is they are overreached, they're overstretched. And we have to reset the military after or beginning now, and I think the budgets are beginning to do that, and they should. My solution to this problem, and I shouldn't use the word solution. My concern about it is that when a president makes the decision to intervene, I want to make sure that the president is reaching out to all elements of opinion in the country and not just talking to people whose job depends on the president's approval. And let me tell you my chief worry here. My chief worry is the politicalization of intelligence. I do not know of a president of the United States who has been told intelligence on a major item, on minor items, yes, that he disagreed with. In other words, at the very top of your intelligence community are very good people, but they are beholden to the president. And the temptation to tell the president what he wants to hear is overwhelming. It's a slam dunk, Mr. President. Some of you may know that, and I'll conclude here. Some of you may know the name Richard Helms. Richard Helms was the director of the CIA many years ago, and he got into some trouble. But he was a thoroughgoing professional in intelligence, and he used to say to us, "My job is to tell the President of the United States what I know, what I don't know, and what I think I know. And Mr. President, when you get around to talking policy, I'm out of here." That's my ideal of the intelligence officer. And at the end, there isn't any institutional way in which you solve this problem of making sure that the president gets honest advice. At the end of the day, it depends on the integrity of the people at the top. That's what it depends on.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.